JSA in the 90s. This episode, Justice Society of America number 3, cover dated October 1992. Hello, and welcome to the JSA in the 90s, a podcast dedicated to the Justice Society of America and related characters as published in the 1990s. We are a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. My name's the Irredeemable Shag, and I'm your host, but I'm not flying solo, folks. Every single episode, we feature a different guest host. And my guest host today, he is an accomplished writer, having written comic stories for DC Comics and Dark Horse and IDW on beloved franchises such as the JSA, Star Wars, and Ghostbusters. He's also written numerous essays and books on comic book history and other prose fiction novels. Beyond that, he's currently podcasting about classic Doctor Who television stories. So, as you can imagine, the Venn diagram overlap of stuff that both he and I adore is surprisingly large. Folks, please help me welcome Mr. Jim Beard. Welcome to the JSA Brownstone, Jim. Thanks for being here, man. How you doing?
Hey, you think that makes me sound pretty cool, huh?
You sound pretty cool to me.
Okay. Oh, I just called the Thunderbolt.
It's because I'll let you know in about 45 minutes whether I still think you're cool or not. How's that?
Okay. And you know what? We should probably warn everybody. This is going to be the very first episode of this podcast that's 3 to 4 hours long.
Don't say that. The first episode was 2.5 hours, and I'm still hearing from people about it.
Yeah, it's funny. I hear about that, too.
I bet everyone does. I saw it in a bathroom wall the other day. So Jim and I, we both love the JSA. We love Doctor Who, Marvel Team-Up, Zorro, classic RPGs, so many things that we both have in common, which is great. But I want to hear from Jim about his connection, and this is fascinating, folks, his connection with the JSA in comic books. Do you mind sharing with us, Jim?
Yeah, I'm very proud to say that I actually have an official JSA story published by DC. That happened back in, wow, I got to set the time machine back here for a moment. 2002 was JLA JSA Secret Files number 1, and I have a three or four page story. Come on, Shag,
you wrote it, Jim, not me.
I know. It's like, well, there's a funny story about that. I pitched it as a 3-page story.
Mm-hmm.
And when it was accepted by Ivan Cohen, used to be an editor at DC, and I still keep in contact with him on Facebook, he actually calls me up on my birthday. I love that. And to say, hey, well, listen, we're going to buy your story, but here's the thing. We need it to be a page longer. Do you think you can do that? Like, what? Like, let me react to each part of this thing in turn, or my head's gonna explode. You know, yeah, that was just an amazing, fantastic thing. I am a huge fan of the Android Red Tornado.
Well, somebody had to be.
It's
I don't really mean that. I don't mean that.
No, listen to me. I have to tell you something. Like, anybody can be an Alan Scott or a Jay Garrick fan. You know, it takes real balls to be a Red Tornado fan.
That is true. You got to have thick skin. You got to be thick-skinned.
Yes, yeah. Oh, poor Reddy. And they're still beating him up in comics. I mean, literally, like, Mark Waid just did it again, you know? But one of the things that's always kind of pissed me off is that as the years went on, Reddy was incorporated more into the Justice League.
Mm-hmm.
And people tended to forget that he began with the Justice Society.
Yeah, very true.
To the point where even official, like, reference material, reference books, whatever, from DC or licensed, you know, through DC, we're starting to say, you know, he was created by T.O. Morrow to infiltrate the Justice League. And it's like, no. So I said, I want to do a story where we set that back. And it's like, you got to reinforce his original connection to the Justice Society. And so that's what I did in that story. It was really, really, really fun, a really fun time. Flash forward to the JSA comic of the 2000s. And when Geoff Johns was writing the title, and he and I used to talk a lot, and he used to tell me plots, and that He sent me the script for JSA number 55. Don't ask me what year that was.
Oh, I should know this off the top of my head.
Oh, come on now. I count on you.
I think it's 2003. I feel like it
okay.
is.
Okay. All right. Wow. No. That can't be right. Is it?
All right. I'm going to look that up while you tell the story, because maybe I've got a story about that comic that you probably already know, but I want to reinforce here.
So I read the script and I say, I love that you took my idea and ran with it. And he's like, oh, yeah. So I'm the ghost co-plotter of that issue.
That is amazing. And by the way, it is from 2003. I was right.
Okay.
And here on the Fire and Water Podcast Network, on the JSA Presents feed, for those of you who started with JSA in the 90s, this feed existed for a couple years before JSA in the 90s started. And we did an episode back in December of 2023 where we specifically covered JSA number 55 as our Christmas episode that year. Me and Paul Keehan talked about, and we waxed that issue's car forever, because that issue was so amazing. And the fact that you had anything to do with it is incredible, sir.
Yeah, so I appreciate that. If I may toot my own horn here, that was my idea, to bring Mahunkle back.
Oh, wow.
Mahunkle is my second most favorite fictional character of all time, right after Batman.
Wow! And I mean, they're so similar.
Yeah. Oh, totally. I mean, you know, if you didn't know when they were created, you would wonder, you know, which one was inspired by which one. You know, it is really just, it's mind-blowing. And then the whole thing about her, like, how could she possibly still be around? And the whole thing about the witness protection program that she's separated from her family and all of that. Jeff said it as a Christmas story, which I absolutely love. And it's got that just knockdown, gorgeous Leonard Kirk art in it.
It's gorgeous.
I'm very proud to own an original page from.
Plus, no way.
He did full inked sketches of Mahunkle, as he put it, then, and Mahunkle now, and I have those.
Okay, you better make sure your address isn't on the internet, or some of these nerds might come knocking around, because that's incredible, man. And that,
and it's funny. I used to collect original pages of art from modern comic books that used Mahunkle, and a few I never could track down, but I do have a couple from different things like Young Justice and JSA itself. There was actually a cameo by Golden Age Red Tornado Statue in an issue that the editor made Steve Sadowski take it out.
No way.
He said it was too distracting. It was like in the background, and he said it was too distracting.
That's
and they
not
put a, they
fair.
Put a patch over it. This was back when they would do things like, they would, you know, digitally do it. They literally had him put a, you know, a rubber cemented patch over the whole statue. And I got that page from him and carefully lifted that patch off and stuck it to the back of that board. So
that is fantastic. Yeah,
so
those
are my brushes with JSA greatness in the comic books.
Well, hey, first of all, I feel incredibly honored to have you on the show, someone who's got some true JSA creds, which is great. And I'm so excited you can be here to share your love with us. I know you love this Mike Paraback series as well.
I just love it to death. And I'm going to be really honest with you. The pain still reverberates through me to this day of its cancellation.
Right.
I'll never forget the feeling when I found out that book was canceled after only it's 10 issues, right?
Well, yeah. And here's the thing relevant to this issue is the cancellation was announced in between the publication of issues 3 and 4.
Yeah.
So you read this issue, right? And you're feeling super energized. And then you hear before the next issue hits the stand, it's canceled. And just, I can't, you said you can remember. I can't remember specifically feeling it. I was working at the comic shop at the time. I don't remember specifically the emotions of it or anything, but I got to imagine it just took all the wind out of my sails. Just like, what? This thing?
I'm not surprised in the slightest, because it was like the comic I didn't know I needed.
Yeah.
You know, when it started unfolding, rolling out, it was one of those special books that I looked forward to every issue. And you hear about those from fans. We all have those books.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and this was one of those. In fact, this is, you know, know, if it's not the top of the heap, it's very close to the top of the heap of those things. There were even rumors going around back then that it was canceled before issue one even came out.
I heard those same rumors working in the comic shop. I heard that.
But now listen, and you, I know you know this very, very well. We JSA fans, and this is wrong and bad, but we can't help it. We expect things like this.
Expect cancellations, you mean? Or?
Well, dumping on the JSA and then bulk cancellations. There was a really wonderful gag cartoon that was printed in Comic Buyer's Guide. It was after this book was canceled. So it was by a cartoonist named Mark Engblom.
Mm-hmm.
And it's literally like the JSA standing there, and it says like 1940, and they're all, you know, fists on their, you know, waist, and, you know, we're the JSA. And then a door slams. It says like 1949, whatever it is.
Okay.
Door slams in their face. And then it's like 1960, whatever it was, three, you know. And it's like, hey, we're back, folks. The next panel, door slams in their face. You know, it's like a couple years later. And this keeps going. I don't know. It's hot. It was like four or five tiers, and then it got down to this. Hey, and then, but they're very weakly and meekly going, oh, hey, folks, we're back. And and it was one of those ones where it's funny, but it's true.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you take the 1980s out of the factor, and you take the Geoff Johns era out of the factor, there's a repeated history of it. Those were the two sort of outliers, and thank goodness they exist, those two eras, because we got so much material. But yeah, it happens over and over.
Yeah. To be a JSA fan is to expect that they'll have the door slammed in their face. And for the most part, you know, it did happen after the end of the Geoff Johns JSA series. Then, I mean, we hit Flashpoint, and then
we got
that really weird Earth 2 series.
It's been a whole series of ups and downs. I mean, especially after Flashpoint, it kept happening over and over and over. And then we kept getting promised, you know, hey, the JSA is coming back. Every time there was a big crossover event, the JSA is coming back. You know, it took forever for that to happen. And who knows now? We all got our fingers crossed for the Geoff Lemire series. Hopefully that's going to last forever. But what we need to do now, though, is we do need to take a second to thank our sponsors. Folks, this episode of JSA in the 90s is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for hardcovers, trades, and other collect editions, all for up to 42% off with free shipping on orders of $50 or more. Now, each episode will select a collect edition to briefly discuss from the InStockTrades library, and usually it's tied into the discussion in some way, shape, or form. This time out, I picked Crisis on Multiple Earths Trade Paperback Book 3, Countdown to Crisis. This thing is great. It's got a ton of the JLA-JSA crossovers. It's got the Death of Mr. Terrific. It's got that Fourth World JSA-JLA crossover, which is great. It's got Crisis on Earth Prime, my favorite. And it's got another crossover featuring the Secret Society of Supervillains, which features an important villain to this issue. So you've got writers like Jerry Conway, George Perez, Marv Wolfman, and others. Artists Dick Dillon and George Perez and Rich Buckler, Don Heck, and others. Covers by Kevin Nolan. It's 472 pages. This thing's huge. This is as big as an old school phone book, practically. Full color, soft cover. It's normally $39.99, but you can get it for 42% off, so it's only $23.19. And come on, it's worth it just for the Crisis on Earth Prime alone. So now, I gotta ask you, Jim, did you happen to bring an InStock Trades pick?
Yeah, I gotta throw one out here, but don't hate me, it's a Marvel book. I don't get a lot of DC trades because I have, like, the original.
Right,
stuff,
sure.
You know, right?
Yep.
But I want to highly recommend something, and maybe this will help. It's very timely.
Oh, and, is that a pun? Is that a pun?
Yeah, you saw what I did there. It's Avengers, The Children's Crusade.
Oh,
because
okay.
If anybody's watching Agatha All Along right now on Disney Plus, they really need to pick up that book. It's not only amazing story, it's got amazing characters, and maybe the best part of it all is it's just got gorgeous Jim Cheung artwork in it.
It's really impressive. It really is.
Some of his just best work. And if you're a Doctor Doom fan, you got to get this story.
And that's a great pick, Jim. That is an absolutely great pick. Great story. And yes, it is very timely, sir. Well done. Well done. Folks, for these and all your other trade paperback needs, please visit InStockTrades.com. Now, this episode is also sponsored in part with your Patreon support, because running the Fire and Water podcast network with so many shows, requires a lot of online hosting and other services, and a while back, we realized we needed some help with the expenses. So we launched a Patreon, and you folks really stepped up to help keep the network going. So if you're enjoying the JSA in the 90s podcast, the best way to support the show is by visiting our Patreon, which is patreon.com/FWpodcast. And while you're there, please consider supporting the network. And at certain tiers, you get mentioned on your show of choice, just like these folks who asked specifically to be recognized on the Justice Society Presents podcast. So our thanks go out to Alex Osias, Bill Beer, Bruno Diaz, David S. Gutierrez, DC Dave, Devin Clancy, George Van Note, Gord Tolton, Jason Keen, Jay Campbell, John Coos, Keith G. Baker, Kevin Wetter, Mark Baker Wright, Martin Gray, Matt Ev, Maxwell Traver, Michael Bailey, Michael Crouch, Mike Zemkowski, a lot of Mikes in that list, Roger Preeb, Russell Burbage, Sean Ross, Superman Radio Revisited Podcast, Symbol Pending, Ted Kilvington, and Tim Price. Again, thank you all to our Patreon supporters and to those folks who asked to be recognized on the JSA Presents. And again, visit our Patreon at patreon.com/FWpodcast. Now, folks, as I always say, this show is about building a community of online JSI fans together. So please get on the social media. You can find us as JSA Presents on almost all the social medias. Engage with us there. More importantly, go out to our website, fireandwaterpodcast.com/JSA, and share your comments on the show post. That's how you get read in the feedback section. So, but now I got to ask you, Jim, I mean, you shared a little bit already, but what is your personal origin story of the JSA? How'd you discover the book? How'd you fall in love?
I had to look this up because I wanted to be absolutely certain. The very first superhero book, comic book my dad ever bought me was 100-page Super Spectacular DC 14. And that was, I got that in December of 1972. I even have a date stamp on the cover of my copy of it.
Oh, wow.
And that was the book that I discovered Wildcat.
It's a
Batman heavy book, which was fine with me. It's got a whole bunch of Golden Age stories in it. Interestingly enough, it's got the first Silver Age Adam story in it.
Ooh, okay.
It had this character named Wildcat, and so this is what I call my entry into the JSA. I absolutely loved it. It was the introduction to Stretch Skinner. I just was so intrigued by Wildcat because he was kind of Batman adjacent, right?
Sure. I can see that. Sure.
Yeah, especially kind of the way he was drawn then. But my first real JSA story was just a few months later, March 1973, was 100-page Super Spectacular DC 17. And that was a Justice League issue, but it had a reprint of All-Star 37, which was the Injustice Society story.
Ooh, there you go.
Dude, I have to tell you, when your first JSA story that you ever see is mostly drawn by Alex Toth, well, you're in a sweet spot.
That's nice.
Everything for me begins visually, and that's the story behind nearly every superhero or villain that I ever liked. It all began visually. I used to be a visual artist before I became a writer and editor, and I just fell in love with Toth's art. And most importantly, that story made me a Dr. Midnight fan, and to this day, Dr. Midnight is my most favorite JSA member.
Oh, that's nice.
Always has been since some, what, that 1973. I was almost 8 years old when I got that book, so I've been a Dr. Midnight fan since I was 8.
So this really is a perfect issue for you this time.
See? Yeah, I mentioned that to you earlier. Yeah, I couldn't believe it that you're like, yeah, how about Justice Society of America number 3? And I pull it out and I'm like, oh my god, this is the Dr. Midnight issue, and how perfect is that?
That's awesome.
And it's interesting, I didn't get my first, you know, quote unquote new JSA story until 1974, so a year later, when my dad got me JLA number 113, another 100-page Super Spectacular.
Mm-hmm.
You're gonna note that those things loom large in my and large is the operative word. I mean, to get those books was just like, well, you said it, like getting a phone book.
Right.
Know? And I love it because it's one of the JLA-JSA team-ups that a lot of people hate or look down upon because it's a one-parter. It's the Sandy the Golden Boy.
Right. The Sandy the Golden Boy one. Exactly. We covered that not too long ago on a JSA Presents. It's a fun story. There's a lot to love about
it. So fun. I love it because Wes Dodds returns to his original outfit in it. It's just so much fun. I loved it to death. And I used to look for to get an original page of art from that story. So it's Dick Dillon, like at his best.
Mm-hmm. You
know, before he kind of deteriorated, you know. And then several years ago, I was talking with a guy and I mentioned that. And he goes, oh, I have that entire story, the original art. And I went, I'm sorry, you mean some of it? And he goes, no, every single page of it.
Oh my gosh.
He said, I got it. And I can't remember the story behind it. And so I hate that guy. I can't even remember his name. And I'm still with him. He's probably listening to this right now. And
you blotted him from your mind forever.
Yeah, you know, right. Yeah, yeah. You are dead to me, buddy. Dead. You understand how that works?
Oh yeah, my gosh.
I was like, could you please write it into your will that I get that?
Right.
It needs to go to me, not anybody else. But you know what? But then I realized that I love the idea that I actually knew somebody who had the original.
Sure. Yeah.
He got it all at once, all in one fell swoop.
Man.
So, I mean, and I never looked back. I mean, I followed the JSA up until very recently when DC didn't seem to know what to do anymore. We're right back to where we started from. Don't know what to do with that JSA of mine.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, but, you know, I mean, I always will be, no matter what. At one point, my fandom reached its peak. When I first started to do things online, I took the name JSA Jim, but before I wanted to, you know, reveal my full name online before I became a published writer. And it's so funny, I still have people on like Facebook or somewhere kind of come up to me and go, did you used to be JSA Jim?
Oh, that's so funny.
Yeah, that's me, yeah.
That's one more thing we have in common. My first online handle on the DC message boards was Super Squad. So it was a JSA related title.
No, wait a minute. I knew somebody who had that handle. Was it you?
I mean, I had that handle. I wasn't terribly prolific, though. I don't know that okay. I was enough to be recognized. Okay. So
I wonder, you know, it might have been somebody else. Real quick, Yahoo used to have a thing called group or clubs.
They had clubs. They had groups. Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah,
clubs became groups.
Okay.
And they had different themes. And I ran the JSA Appreciation Association or the JSA. AAA for a few years, and at one point it was the largest comic book related club on Yahoo.
I can't make any promise here, but I suspect I was a member of that because I joined a lot of Yahoo clubs and then groups over the years, and that one sure sounds familiar.
That was back in the day where you could easily interact with the writers, artists, the editors. They were all a part of that group. Jeff was, Steve, Leonard Kirk, Pete Tomasi. We even had James Robinson on there a little bit. We used to do chats with them, like live chats. It was a glory day. My big bragging rights is that I hosted the very first and potentially maybe still to this day only live online chat with Roy Thomas.
Oh, wow.
It was at least the very first one.
Fascinating.
Ever done. Yeah. Those were glory days.
The Wild West days of the internet.
Right. That was just as that JSA was beginning. I met Jeff because he sent me an email and said, hey, I got this book coming out called Stars and Stripe.
Oh,
and blah, blah, blah. Blah, 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 and we became friends after that.
Well, Jim, that is absolutely astonishing. You have most certainly proven your bona fides, sir. There is no doubt about that.
No, that wasn't the point of it all.
Oh, no, and that wasn't a dig at all. I mean, I'm in awe and thrilled I even have you on the show right now, and I'm going to pick your brain on something else. All right, okay. You ready for this?
Yeah.
So I kind of want to have a little discussion topic each episode. We'll see if this works out or if it ends up taking up too much time in each episode, but
okay.
I've been thinking a lot about Al Pratt's costume redesign in this series.
Yeah.
Specifically, what he debuted last issue number 2, and he's wearing it again here. And I just started thinking, I was thinking more and more about it, and I'm sort of fascinated that it just shows up in the comic without really any discussion, right? Mm-hmm. It's just there. And yeah. Until I really started breaking it down, I didn't realize how kind of interesting it is. Like, first of all, it just looks cool, right? It just looks awesome. But it was only around for a short while. Like, it debuts in 1992, and sadly, Al's dead by 95, so the costume was only around, I know, it's too soon, I know,
yeah.
But it was only around for like 3 years, and yeah. Yet it's got this interesting legacy. So, all right, so folks, if you don't have a copy of the comic in front of you, what it is he's got the sort of a blue bodysuit, and it comes up to sort of an arrow point on his chest. The top of his shirt is yellow. He's sleeveless. He's got the brown leather bracers. He's got like a brown neck piece, and he's got the usual blue hood, and then he's got brown boots. So, and you can see a lot of this art on our website, fireandwaterpodcast.com/JSA. But so it was an update from the original costume. And I started thinking about it. And that's when I came to the realization, the upwards arrow pointing on his chest, the blue arrow, actually doesn't come from any one of his original costumes. I think it's a purposeful nod to Ray Palmer's first costume. Yeah. Am I crazy by saying that?
No, it's got to be. It's got to be. Do we know for a fact this was Parobek's design?
I don't know that for sure. I can't imagine who else it would have been.
Yeah, it really speaks volumes that of the entire team, Al gets the full redesign.
Mm-hmm.
They're only going to get little tweaks on everybody else, which really says a lot about those costumes.
Oh,
that
yeah.
They could survive from 1941, you know, until now.
We're going to be talking about Dr. Midnight's costume in a minute, trust me. So, yeah.
Good. you know, Al's costume, it's so funny because, like I said, that this comic book is the comic book I didn't know I need.
Mm-hmm.
He's the redesign I didn't realize I needed.
Yeah, that's fair too.
And when you got it, you just went, yeah.
It just looks right.
It's so clever. It does. There's a lot of crummy redesigns out there. Alan Scott Sentinel. Pardon me. I had something caught in my throat there. But Al's, I love it because it's a little bit of nods to everything with a then nice modern vibe to it too.
That's absolutely fair. That's absolutely fair. And I love the nod. And the Ray Palmer thing, I didn't realize till just the other day. And that's an even nicer nod to the legacy of the Atom, right? It's just such a great idea that maybe everyone else but me picked up on it. Maybe I'm just the last one to realize. But it was just shocking to me when I'm like, oh my God, that's absolutely a Ray Palmer thing.
Yeah. And it gets more fascinating if you look at it as an in-universe thing. You would say, so that's really cool. Al would acknowledge Ray.
Mm.
But he doesn't really have to. Ray comes after him.
Yep.
But I think it's because Al's been gone. He's been in limbo. He comes back. He looks around and he says, I got to acknowledge these guys that kept on when we were gone, you know. And I like it because I don't know if there was ever too much about how he felt about Ray Palmer. But to me, like, I guess, as the kids would say, my head canon is, mm-hmm. is softened on Ray maybe once he comes back. And he incorporates a motif of it into his own outfit. That is definitely the one JSA original outfit that really needed it, because, you know, I mean, it was starting to look like some kind of weird circus bondage costume.
Yeah. Absolutely. So
do you see the neck brace as a nod to the, you know, leather, you know, bustier that he used to wear?
Well, I always saw it as like a weightlifter belt kind of thing originally, but the neck piece, I hadn't given a lot of thought. I just assumed it was brown fabric, but yeah, it does appear to be bulkier and like a leather sort of neck brace. It might be. Huh.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like, and I'd love to hear from people if they feel otherwise. I feel like that's the nod to the, you know, that lower abdomen, mid abdomen mm-hmm. thing that he wore, which was absolutely like a, you know, a weightlifter type of thing. I mean, that's really, you know, his whole shtick there. So glad that they kept the full face mask.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that just screams Adam. When they went to the more traditional conventional superhero outfit in the 40s, even though the original one was kind of embarrassing, it was also kind of embarrassing that they said Adam's got to have a more conventional outfit.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's like making Dr. Fate have a half helmet all of a sudden.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, no, you have something really unique there. Both those guys, full face masks. Why take that away?
And I think that because Dr. Fate, all he really did was change that part of it. I think the Adams is so much more jarring. And I'm not saying the fin head design is bad, but it doesn't do much for me. I like it better in, was it Cyclotron, I guess, is the one who takes it in All-Star Squadron, if I remember right. And so, yeah, I agree that if you got to go, you go the original costume or you go this post-90s one, which, again, interestingly, only around for 3 years. And yet the legacy, though, too, it gets picked up by Atom Smasher. He has definite nods to that costume. It gets picked up by Damage. Both of them have very obvious nods to this costume from the 90s. In fact, I posted this on Facebook just in preparation for this episode. I was just like, oh, I'll just share this out and, you know, tell people kind of what's on my mind. it kind of took off on Facebook.
It did. Like
a lot of comments. And we actually got feedback from two of the creators from the JSA books. So I'll just kind of read this to you fairly quickly. So Steven Sadowski, the penciler on the 1999 JSA series, oh my gosh, he chimed in and he says, a fun fact, when I designed the Atom Smasher costume for the JSA in 2000, my original color choice was yellow in blue in homage to this costume of the Atoms. He said the powers that be decided there was too much yellow on the team, and so red was needed. So that's why you get Atom Smasher in red and blue. And he says that he didn't really fight too hard about it, but in his headcanon, it was always secretly red and blue, or yellow and blue. And he says if you switch out the red for yellow on Atom Smasher's costume, you can see it was a pretty clear homage to this Atom's costume. And he also said the red also worked because it's a nice nod to Nuklon's history, so it made it easier to swallow. That was amazing. Now, you said you remember Steven telling you this, right?
Yeah, that seemed really, really familiar. I'm a Steve Sadowski fanboy, an amazing artist, and always has a great behind-the-scenes story. And I'm so glad he chimed in on that one. He had some real passion for the looks of the characters. And there were more stories about things that he didn't get through, you know, that he really believed it should be this. But, you know, you work for somebody, it's work for hire.
Yeah.
I've heard those arguments before. There's too much of this or that color on the team. Well, it could be argued there was too much red, you know? I mean, literally with just Jay and Alan. I mean, you know, both guys in full red shirts. Carter's got a little bit of red going on, shorts and the, you know, the chest emblem. And I don't know. I always think that's kind of silly. But, you know, wait a little bit and some artist will come along, maybe hear that story, maybe like that idea, and then, you know, that finally comes to fruition down the line.
Right. Yeah.
I'm really glad he liked this Parobek design.
Oh, yeah.
Pardon me. If it is a Parobek design, and I really hope somebody chimes in somewhere and says, yeah, that Mike absolutely did that.
I hope that's the case. I hope that. And also, it's worth mentioning when Damage shows up in his sort of tribute costume, his is blue and yellow as well.
Yeah.
Now, speaking of colors, Glenn Whitmore also chimes in that same thread, who's the colorist on the series we're covering right now in this 1992 JSA series.
Wow.
And Bruno Diaz, who's one of our followers on the show, by the way, and supports the show, he commented about Starman's cowl being green, because we've talked about that. In the promo material, it was green. Issue 1, it was green. And he talked about Al Pratt's hair being changed from red to brunette. Glenn Whitmore chimed in. He says, guilty as charged regarding Starman's cowl. He says, however, Mike, now he didn't specify if he meant Mike Parobek or Mike Macklin. I'm going to assume it's Mike Parobek, but he goes, Mike never drew a distinct separation between Starman's cape and cowl. The original design did have that. So editor Brian Augustine never asked him to fix it. So that's why he made that cowl green, is because the cape and the cowl appeared to be one piece by per the artwork. So that's why it was green. Not so because someone didn't know what they were doing. It's because of that costume, the way it was drawn, which is fascinating.
To me, that's a case of just because you can do a thing doesn't mean you should. I see the path that the thinking went down for that, but I've always hated it.
And I'm so glad you're on the show, and I'm so glad you're just sharing a completely wrong opinion, because the green.
You know, I think it's really cute how delusional you are.
Because if Adam can get a full costume, why can't, you know, Ted get a green cowl? I think it looks sharp.
No, it looks completely wrong. Dude, you spend decades with a red cowl. No, it's like Superman with no trunks. You need to break up the... No. Look.
There's a book I'd like you to read. It's called Who Moved My Cheese?
look, Starman from boots to, you know, green boots, red tight, green shorts, red shirt, green cape, red cowl. Come on, you see the pattern there? Red, green, red, green, red, green.
Well, thanks, everyone. That's our show.
I know, right?
No, I got to share one more thing from Glenn real quick.
I'm not moving off of that. I'm going to die on that hill.
You can die on that hill, and I'll laugh at you while I wear my green cowl.
Listen, I agree with you about Al Pratt. Can't you give me just one thing? I suppose you like Carter's gold T-shirt.
In this series? I absolutely do in this series.
Oh!
So here's, okay. Well, first of all, I don't want to see a 70-year-old man's bare chest. So I'm just saying.
You know what? And I knew you were going to say that.
He said it himself in issue number 2. He says, no one's going to see my chest anymore except for Shiera, which is great. So Glenn shares another thing. He gives another inconsistency from issue number 1. Mike drew Hawkgirl's helmet like the Earth One version, and the cover colors Bob LaRose followed suit with the Earth One color scheme. Yellow top, orange hair. Independently on the interiors, I colored her top red and gave her brown auburn hair like the Earth 2 version. So there you go. So that's a little correction, which was great, because we did all, a lot of us did notice the helmet design was a little bit off. But most importantly, thank you so much to Glenn Whitmore and Steve Sadowski for sharing that information. It just so incredible that they were willing to share that information with us. And it was great.
If you ever meet Steve, you know, buy him a drink and ply him for JSA stories.
Oh, I will. I will.
Be disappointed. you know, my own is the whole thing about the Mahunkle statue that he had to have covered up.
Well, Steve, if you happen to be listening, this show will go for about 2 or 3 years as JSA in the 90s, and then it's going to become JSA in the 2000s. And if you're interested, I would love to have you on the show, man. Just saying. So that, now, Jim,
I'm going to be a 3 to 4 hour episode.
I'll take that every day, all day long. Now I'm going to ask you, Jim, because I haven't made this episode long enough already. So here we go. a question for you. What is your favorite JSA costume redesign? Since we're talking about Al's redesigned costume for the Atom, what is your favorite JSA costume redesign? Now, it could be any costume for even an original JSA member who changed their costume or one of their legacy characters. Whatever. What do you got?
Oh, so it doesn't have to be in this book.
No, not in this book at all. Oh, just okay. In general. Yeah. In the 84 year history of the JSA.
Okay. Sit down. You're sitting down. I want you to be ready for this one.
I'm listening.
It's like my unpopular JSA opinion.
Okay.
I liked Sandy Hawkins' first costume in the James Robinson at first series, the original sand costume.
You are not going to get a conflict from me on that. It's not on my list of favorites. It's not on my list of favorites. But
we're back together again.
the baseball cap with a little kind of snug mask and everything, and you know, kind of the green fatigue shirt. It looks great, man.
Fatigue shirt? Yeah, yeah. I was pretty unhappy when that went away. Steve did not design that, but if I remember correctly, he liked that outfit.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a shame that it took so long for him to be given the name Sandman. Never understood that. Sand always graded me.
Oh gosh. I had always heard it was supposed to be Sand Blast, and they changed it to Sand. I don't know if that's true or not.
I've never heard that story.
Okay, so that's probably just nerds making up crap. Okay.
I will now rue the day I heard that story from because that's the worst crap I've heard in a long time.
Come on. Sand Blast and Atom Smasher, they sound like they work together.
No, but Atom Smasher is a thing. No, Sand Blast.
So, all right, I actually have a few on my list.
Storm would may have made more sense, don't you think?
Oh, it was Sandstorm. That's what I heard, not Sandblast.
What you do?
I'm a dude.
Right. We're back apart again.
No. I'm not saying I loved it. I had heard. You're right. It was Sandstorm that I had heard, not Sandblast. Oh okay. My god. See, yeah. That's what 20 years will do to you, my memory.
Yeah. But, oh my god. Was it that long ago?
More than that. It was 1999. So that's 25 years ago. All right. Yeah. So do you have any? I actually have a few on my list. So do you have any more costume redesigns that are your favorites?
You know, I can go the other way when, you know, with the whole Sentinel thing, not necessarily, although, I always pretty much liked the Dr. Midnight 2, not,
talk about Beth,
Piotr.
Okay. Yeah.
Spider Cross. I always kind of liked that one because that was a nice updating without going off the rails.
I like it. That actually made my list of what I called minor tweaks. Yeah. Because it's basically the costume, but just like you said, it's a little more modern, a little more armorish. Yeah, that's a great little minor tweak. I would say Jesse Quick is kind of falls in the same category. It's really just a minor tweak from Johnny Quick because it's just, you know, it's a female version of it. Or Power Girl, you know, like when Amanda Connor draws Power Girl, she's drawing pretty much the original costume, but she's got, you know, piping on the costume now. She's putting just little tiny design elements. So all those fall in my kind of mindset of like minor tweaks. So yeah, good call. on that one.
We need to have an entire episode where we just talk about Power Girl.
I do plan on doing that in the 2000s. Okay. Not a lot to say in the 90s, unless I want to talk about Justice League Europe, and I don't. So
yeah, I will never be mistaken for a Power Girl fan. I hated the character the moment she was on panel in the 70s.
Wow, you just lost one of my listeners. Symbol Pending has an entire blog dedicated to Power Girl.
I'm sorry about that. Yeah, very, very bad parody written by a man of women's lib in the 70s.
But they've done so much with her since. But all right, so back to costumes. Really? Hold on. Back to costumes.
Okay, sorry. How about this one? Here's another unpopular opinion. And it's funny because I just was talking about going from the Adam's more unique costume to giving him a more typical superhero costume. Mm-hmm. Actually, as much as I love the original Sandman costume, I actually also love the... It's not actually Kirby's, but it's been thought of as the Kirby and Simon and Kirby costume.
Oh, the yellow one with the hourglass? Or
the purple and gold.
The purple and gold? Oh, that one. Oh, that hideous thing.
Yeah.
You're talking about the tarantula's costume.
Say that like that's a bad thing.
I'm not a fan of the purple and yellow costume. Okay. I'm sorry.
Okay. I think a lot of it has to do with that it was mostly drawn by Simon and Kirby.
Yeah, well, hey, there's a lot to like about it. That story, though, where he starts wearing it for no apparent reason, has to fight a bunch of bees as he meets Sandy. I mean, it's... So, all right, I'm going to, since you're just going off the rails naming nonsense at this point, I'll name the three best costume redesigns for you. How's that?
Okay.
The first one is a double act. It is taking the original Star Spangled Kid and Stripesy and coming up with Courtney and Pat as Stars and Stripe, which eventually becomes Stargirl. Fantastic redesign all the way around. Very clever changes.
Yeah. The Stargirl costume is one of the best, quote unquote, modern superhero costumes. And the compliment to it is that it's still the same to this day.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the translation to the screen in the recent Stargirl series was just gorgeous.
Yeah. So that's absolutely a fantastic one. I love Mr. Terrific, Michael Holt. I love it because, Terry Sloan's costume is redunculous, right? I mean, he's got like curtains that have come up to show his abdomen with Fair Play and all this stuff.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I love it.
I which one, Michael Holt or Terry Sloan?
I love both of them, but I like Terry's more.
As much as I love, I mean, I don't get me wrong, I'm making fun of Terry's costume, but I still love it. I've still got the little mini JSA statuette over here on my shelf.
I was going to say you were one of the guys that called the 900 number to kill off Terry Sloan, right?
No, I was not. No, that was my first JSA comic, though, was 171, The Death of Mr. Terrific. Yep.
Holy moly.
The third most great costume redesign for JSA is Jack Knight Starman. I mean, just such a clever change. And at first look, you're like, what? That's not even a costume. That's just ridiculous. But as the series goes, it grows on you and it just works.
It becomes a costume.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it becomes an actual look. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Who would have thought? But please note that David did not wear the green cowl that I remember.
Oh my gosh. Are we back on that? Really?
Yeah, we are.
Okay. Well, now that we're on hour four of the podcast, why don't we talk about this comic book?
Oh, crap. There's a comic book that we have to talk about?
I know. Isn't that crazy? So, folks, if you can't seem to locate your issue of Justice Society of America number 3, first, go put yourself in timeout. Then, when you come out of timeout, you can go to our website, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com/JSA, and I will post a few pages from there. But come on, people. Go buy yourself the soft copy of this thing, or it's out there digitally. It's on DC Infinite. You got to get your hands on it. So, this is Justice Society of America number 3, published by DC Comics, cover dated October 1992. On the shelf, September 8th, 1992. Cover price is $1.25, 5 shiny quarters. Wow. Cover is by Mike Paraback and Mike Macklin. You want to describe the cover for us?
Yeah, so we've got a close-up on my guy, Wildcat. He's kind of looking up and realizing that something's behind him and Dr. Midnight and the Atom, who share the cover with him. And there are some, I don't know what I want to call these creatures. They're like animal men of some sort, dropping down from the trees out of the dark onto our three JSA stalwarts, and in the background, a strange laughing hooded figure on an equally strange beast.
So For me, historically, I've always kind of dismissed this cover. What? It's just, let me finish. I've always kind of dismissed it just not being very exciting. It didn't really light my fire. But then, and Jim knows this, when you do a podcast, you study stuff way more than you ever should have. And looking at this, spending time with this cover, I realize how incredibly well composed it is and how well it's colored. I really dig this cover now that I've taken the time to pay attention to it. And I'm embarrassed that I didn't respect it as much as I did before. I mean, I love Wildcat. I mean, with Parabak's simple lines, right? The perfect choice of lines, you can tell he looks nervous. You can tell he's raising his hand in caution as if to say, like, hang on a moment, what's going on? You know, the coloring is fantastic because it's making the heroes pop, and those villains that are creeping down on them, they just kind of sink into the background. And it depends on what you're looking at. Like, I will say that the original comic, I enjoy the coloring much more in the original comic versus the DC Infinite version. The DC Infinite version, the colors on the monsters a lot stronger. They don't fade into the background as much as they should. So I do like the physical comic better. But the monsters are kind of muted. It looks great. So obviously you like the cover. I can tell already, right?
I love the cover, and I think it's one of the more unique ones of the series, where you're getting a lot of full figures or maybe even three quarters figures. I love how close we are to the characters. I love it that Wildcat is front and center.
Yeah,
Wildcat will always be. He was my first JSA guy I ever saw, and I love him, and that he got that focus is really nice. I love the way Parabek made the costume like furry.
Yeah.
I think it was always implied over the years, but we never actually really got that. I love the figures dropping down. Now, the monster that's off to the left,
yep.
The coloring, I think maybe should have been more like the coloring of the other two. He's the one that drops out and is muted.
So you're looking at the physical comic rather than the digital, right? Comic.
Yeah. Okay, did they update that? I'm sorry.
Well, they didn't recolor it, but because paper absorbs, you know, kind of eats a lot of color. The colors are a lot more vibrant on the monsters. They don't fade away. They're very much sort of in your face. So I like it better on the physical comic because I think having them sort of fade away into the darkness of the creepy woods works better.
Okay. In the original comic book, he's got this sort of green gray cast to him, where the other guys are like these warmer, you know, russets and browns and whatever. You know what I love? I love the coloring on the logo and that pops.
Yeah.
Kind of reflecting, picking up the flesh tones of Dr. Midnight and Wildcat, the brightness of the top of Al's costume, the yellow there. I really love that. So that coloring is sort of the Indiana Jones Raiders of the Lost Ark look.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. I just know, you know, I got to hand it to you and really thank you for making me pull this out and reread it after all. I haven't read it recently, and I remember pulling it out and kind of forgetting this cover. And I, you know, it's like, I think I was lucky enough to get this issue, but I think I was really lucky to get this issue with this cover because it's always been a favorite of mine.
That's awesome. That's fantastic. Well, why don't we get in the inside? So it is written by Len Strazewski. Penciler is Mike Parabak. Inker is Mike Macklin. Letter is Robert Panaha. Colorist is Glenn Whitmore. Editor is Brian Augustin. And the issue itself is called Out of the Past. Now, folks, normally the way this works is my guest covers one half of the synopsis, and I cover the other half of the synopsis. Jim is such an overachiever that he has written the entire synopsis, and I will never let any subsequent guest live it down. You know, it's always going to be, well, guys, you know, Jim wrote the whole synopsis himself. I'm just saying. So, Jim, why don't you recap the issue for us?
Let's do this thing. So, late at night, an elderly man dies in Dr. Charles McNider's clinic's examining room, but not before he imparts an important message. Ultragen is up to no good with their experiments to allegedly reverse the effects of aging. Meanwhile, Johnny Quick pays his old chums in the JSA a visit to bring them up to date on what he's been doing while they were gone in limbo, including his breakup with Liberty Bell. With the reunions interrupted by McNider and his grave news of Ultragen's own so-called progress and a call to arms to his old teammates. Back at the clinic, an older Johnny Thunder stumbles upon Ultragen goons covering their tracks on the elderly man's corpse, and when Johnny's wounded in a scuffle with them, the Thunderbolt appears and meets an odd young girl who seems to recognize him for what he is, a Bodnesian Hexbolt. Across town, Wildcat, Adam, and Dr. Midnight invade Ultragen's compound covertly that night, only to encounter someone they know very, very well, the Ultra Humanite in a new, more powerful body, as we come to the end of Justice Society of America number 3.
Dun, 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 dun. Yeah, so the Ultra Humanite is back, if you hadn't guessed from Ultra Gen being plastered all over the previous two issues. So
that's called subtle telegraphing. Come on.
Right. I know. I love it. I love it. So first off, Johnny Quick is there in the base, which is great. I don't know if that was really worthy of the cliffhanger from issue 2 of like, who is this? Okay, it's just Johnny Quick, but that's okay. It's a fun idea to turn him into like the Ron Popeil of superheroes, right? With the infomercials. I adore that. And the flashbacks where Johnny's telling his story are really, really nice, because Parabek has laid out these 6 panels, 3 per page, in sort of almost a widescreen format, telling about, you know, him retiring and about everything he's doing. And it's like, you even get these 2 contrasting panels on different pages. Like on the left, it's the scientist laughing at him, and then on the facing page, it's the corporate execs loving him. So it's this really nice contrast. And I'm going to guess, if you're anything like me, your heart broke when he says that him and Liberty Bell broke up. That just crushed me.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. You know what's really interesting about this is that Johnny Quick is a character that could have fallen into disuse very easily, but we've returned to him and kind of made him sort of a minor superstar in the modern era. And it's really interesting because really, I mean, he's just a like an ersatz Flash, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, and they really tried to make it something. And very interestingly, they draw the connection between him in the JSA. He was an All-Star Squadron member.
Yep.
But never a member of the JSA. I love it that in this they almost are saying like, well, you know, he's in really good with the JSA. He's someone that they want to see, that they're going to sit and listen to his story. And yeah, the thing about Liberty Bell, it's nice to get her name checked, and she's actually in a panel there. But yeah, that's pretty sad when that comes up. So have you called 1-900 JC Quick?
I actually Googled it. I'm like, I am not calling this number. There's no way I'm calling this number. But I Googled it to see if I could figure out what it was, and I can't figure it out. I got nothing on it. Did you call it?
No, but I'm pretty sure that was the old number that they used to, if you want to, Terry Sloan to die or not.
Oh my gosh. We're back to that. Okay. So real quick about Liberty Bell. Again, the breakup is incredibly sad. She actually made the promotional poster. So I think they were probably planning on having her show up if the series went beyond the 10 issues. I mean, obviously their daughter is going to play a big role. But later on, James Robinson would use this breakup in a slightly different way and make it earlier, but in his Golden Age story. He would use that piece as part of the story. So now I'm gonna play devil's advocate with you. So that you've okay. said that there's this moment where Johnny's accepted as a JSA adjacent
sort of person. Yeah.
They accept him and everything. I will say, as a reader though, mm-hmm. they're really trusting the reader to know their JSA history. Because if you really pay attention, they don't provide any explanation of who he is. That's for the new point. Readers.
The costume. Costume's not shown.
Yep. Well, it's the glove is in a trash can. They right. do show that. But they don't say that he was or was not part of the JSA. So if I was reading this, I would assume he was a member of the JSA. They don't say how he's connected to it. He does mention his speed formula, and he does have bursts of speed, but there's really nothing specific about running. You don't know that he is, as you said, sort of like the Flash, and you don't see him use the powers. So you're putting a lot of trust in the reader to know that. But now I'll play devil's advocate to myself here, which is, you can muddle along, though. You can follow the story and understand it. And I'm wondering if I'm such a JSA nut that I'm not being fair. Maybe there is enough context clues for the reader to get through this, and I'm just being too much of a, wow, they didn't mention All-Star Squadron number 14, you know, or something like that. I don't know.
Well, ponder this, though. There probably weren't very many people reading this book who didn't know the JSA and all the adjacent characters.
Very true.
So, I mean, I think that's the problem, or at least that's what DC thought.
Yeah.
That this was too dense, or it was too much of a niche book, and that no one's going to care about it, and especially since it's about senior citizens.
But it's so damn good!
What did you think about the more more or less stomping on his speed formula and almost saying we have to bring it into the modern era. We can't, you know, it's stupid. You can't have it where some guy just says a formula and he suddenly can run very fast. You know, it has to be more like a mantra that activates the speed force, you know, or his metagene.
Speed Force wasn't around, I don't think, just yet. But yeah. I like the way they handled it, though, because I like how he's scowling. He's unhappy that the scientists are laughing at him and saying it has something to do with metagene. And then he goes to metaphysicians, you know, these people that do metaphysical stuff, and they help him. So I feel like it's acknowledging that, yeah, saying a formula is a little weird, but you know what? We're going to go with it anyway, because they go to the metaphysical side of it rather than the scientific, you know, Julie Schwartz, everything's got to have a scientific answer to it. So I think it's a good balance just for me. What about you?
No, I'm going to agree with that, that if it has to be done, this was the clever way to do it. You know, props to Len for taking that. You know, I mean, in a perfect world, I would have chosen to preserve the fun and goofiness of somebody yelling out a formula, you know, a weird formula, and that somehow makes him be able to run fast, you know. But again, this was a very clever way. It was fitting it into the opening up of the idea of the metagene in the DC universe. So, you know, I'm good with it in this book.
Yeah. And as we get going, because I haven't read ahead lately, it's been a long time since I've read ahead, and I'm purposely doing this so that I focus on one issue at a time. I'll be interested to see if Jessie does say the formula. I feel like she does. That's in my memory. She didn't say it in number one when she caught the tray, but I just kind of retcon that and I'm saying like she mumbled it.
I feel like she does say it.
Not in issue one. She doesn't. Because they were trying to keep her identity a secret at that point.
Okay.
So in my mind, she just mumbled it to herself.
Okay. That's okay.
Yep. So jumping forward, we get we Dr. Charles McNider being a doctor in his medical capacity. We don't get to see that too often.
No, that's a really, really good point. At one point in the Golden Age, he was an author.
Really?
Like, they moved it away from being a doctor to an author, if I remember this correctly. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Well, I know Tarantula was an author. I didn't realize McNider was an author also.
I'm pretty sure that they did that. And I think that happened to a couple different characters, like where they're background changed.
Okay. Yeah.
In the Golden Age. Yeah.
I love that he talks like an old guy would. He says things like, you know, the way he went shouldn't happen to a dog. And, you know, he hit the skids. I mean, he totally sounds like some guy from the 40s. I love that. I love the dialogue that Straczynski's given him there. It's really great.
I love when he says, you know, you remember Reggie Lipscomb. And then they all chime in.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah, he used to play all the Gotham jazz clubs. He played at my bachelor party. Yeah, I have all of his albums.
That's awesome.
That was really, really fun touches. There.
So good. I got to point something out. I was going to save it for later, but I got to point it out here. We're going to praise Parabek a whole bunch, but he draws so awesome. And like his attention to detail and the way he differentiates characters here. Because here in the room, you've got Johnny Quick, you've got Dr. Charles McNider, and you've got Alan Scott. All are either blonde or white, yellow hair, right? And they're all white dudes who, two of which are just in suits. So they could look identical, but he is made sure that each one of them have unique hairstyles. You know, McNider's got kind of a comb over going on. Alan's got a super receding hairline. Johnny Quick's got like chiseled, gorgeous features. He makes it clear who everyone is, and you're never confused. And he does it with the minimal amount of lines. And I love that about that. And then stepping away from that, you get like Wildcat. You know, he's given Wildcat a weak chin. You know, he doesn't look overweight, but it's just like it's a rounded, weak chin. Whereas Dr. Midnight has this like really broad chin. You know, and the Atom's head is basically a cube, you know, and he does all this with such little, what looks effortless, but you know, a lot of work and attention went into it. And it's just, I can't sing his praises enough.
It's what I would, you know, say called deceptively simple.
Yeah, there you go.
You think it's really cartoony and simple, but once you really get into it and you absorb it, you realize that Mike was a genius.
Mm-hmm.
I fell in love with his work on, if I'm not mistaken, it was the Elongated Man miniseries.
So good. Him and Ty Templeton together? Yes, please.
Oh. Yeah, just now, Mike could suffer from a poor anchor.
Sure.
there were times in the Impact line where there was some pretty weak stuff going on. He did maybe some annuals in there. He did The Fly, and that looked pretty good. But there was somewhere in there where it was starting to fall apart. Now, I'm going to say this because it could be true. It might have had something to do with his ailing health, too.
I suppose that
it was starting to get, you know, line a little weaker. But anyways, like I said, I think maybe a lot of inkers didn't understand Mike.
When you work with someone like Mike Macklin or Ty Templeton or the folks who, I'm not quite sure who was inking him on the Batman Adventures, they really knew what to do. And by the way, one more shout out, the Superman and Batman magazine. I mean.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Wow, I'd forgotten that.
Oh, I haven't. I've got all my issues. I mean, I went crawling through them a couple months ago. I'm like, there's got to be a JSA thing in here somewhere. And there's not. But I was hoping I could cover it on the show, but there's nothing with the JSA at all, which is heartbreaking.
He did some of the JSA miniseries that led into this, didn't he?
Yeah, that was basically a placeholder for all the Impact team. They had to give him something to do. So yeah, So we'll get to talk about him again when we finish this series and we go back to the one from the year previous. Yeah.
Cool.
So there is a moment here. It's almost a kind of a, I don't want to call it a quiet moment, but there's a moment where Jay and Alan are talking, and you know they are in theory the two leads of the series, if you will. But you get Jay and Alan talking, and I like that Alan acknowledges, he's like, hey, you know, just a minute ago, everyone was questioning whether the JSA should still be doing this, and now everyone's jumping into action. And it takes a moment to address how quickly things are moving, and I'm glad they put that in there. And then we get to see Alan do the oath, and I'm always down for that. So I just really like they threw that page in.
This is a gorgeous page in every way. The panel setup, the figures, the coloring, everything. I love when Jay runs off and Alan's cape kind of goes with him.
In
a way. The panels at the bottom with him making the lantern visible are beautiful. And then where he's just bathed in the green glow in that last panel. You know, there's a little bit of, I think, like kind of Neil Adams panel design going on here with those top three, four panels. You know, they're like wedges each other. You know, there's a kind of a little bit of that going on with some of the stuff that Neil was doing, like in the X-Men books, like late 60s, very early 70s. You know, I mean, I'll say it, we're all thinking it anyways, you know, the industry really lost a treasure when it lost Mike Parabek.
Yeah, absolutely.
I miss his work to this day.
Could you imagine the stuff he'd be cranking out today? You know, or like, could you imagine if him and Darwin Cook had gotten to work on something together? You know, or, you know, those two styles, just like seeing Mike and Ty Templeton together was gorgeous. Those two working together would have been gorgeous. There's so many missed opportunities. And
can you imagine Jerry Ordway inking Mike Parabek?
Oh, God. No, it's just brilliant. All right. So let's go forward here. So we get to the clinic, right? And we've got Dr. Midnight's his medical partner there. And then we've got the introduction of Kiku. They don't say her name in the issue. So, and then, you know, you get the Thunderbolt. I can't say this word. What kind of Thunderbolt is it?
Magnesian.
I like that.
Magnesia.
There we go. And so Kiku is going to be, and I am sharing ahead, guys, just because it's in order to talk about the character. She is going to come, she comes from there. And so this is going to be relevant to her, and she's going to be a legacy character for Johnny, which is great. And I like that they were trying to do that. So I do wonder, though, what's she doing there? Is she staking out the clinic, you know, or is she following Johnny Thunder? I mean, I'm sure they'll tell us later, but I have no idea why she's just hanging out on the rooftop watching this.
Listen, here's a redesign that we didn't bring up at all. Talk about it. What do you think about the Thunderbolt redesign?
Yeah, he's got kind of like a, looks almost like a Jack Frost kind of, like, you know, fluffy shoulder pieces and fluffy neck piece and stuff like that. Yeah. It's different.
I was never too sure what I thought about it. I don't hate it, you know, but yeah, maybe it's a little bit too much what you just said. It's not bad.
Yeah, I'll have to think on that one. I'll have to pull out the old, because I did kind of like the more zigzaggy lightning bolt kind of look. Yeah. Huh. I'll have to think. I hadn't put much thought to that.
Did you accept and believe, and I'm not saying one way or the other, did you accept and believe that Johnny Thunder would get portly?
I have no problem with anything bad happening to Johnny Thunder.
Oh my goodness.
Not a fan. Not a fan.
Oh my goodness. Oh yeah. my goodness. I want to, real quick, a little funny story. When I had that JSA group, the JSAAA, my wife was a comic book fan, and she loved a lot of superhero stuff, like the original Lois Lane. She loved Jimmy Olsen, you know, and the amazing transformations of Jimmy Olsen. She loved all that kind of stuff. She actually was reading, I got her to read this book, and she was a big Perelbeck fan. She was also a huge Perelbeck fan in terms of his Johnny Thunder. Ah. She loved Johnny Thunder to begin with, but she loved Mike's. So she was actually in the group or in the club, and her username was the Perelbeck Johnny Thunder.
That's brilliant. I love
that. Yeah, it really, really was. So this brings back a lot of nice memories of her in seeing Johnny in this again. So again, this is another perfect issue for me. love it.
I agree with her. Like, when I picture Johnny in my head, this is the version I think of. I don't think of him as the young kid, this svelte, bumbling guy. I think of him as, you know, a little bit overweight, a little gone to pot, you know, the little older kind of thing. This is how I see him. So, and I do like that they're following this pattern where every issue we seem to get two more characters rolled in. You know, it was Jay and Allen. Then they added Wildcat and Adam. Now we're getting Dr. Midnight and Johnny Thunder. So they seem to be bringing back like two characters at a time just to slowly build the group, rebuild the group again for new readers.
I loved that. It was one of my more favorite things about this series. I think that was a really, really good way to go. Mm-hmm. Instead of literally having the entire team there, you know, in issue one and just running with all of them, you wouldn't have gotten a lot of the character moments.
Right.
Yeah. That we did get. I think that was really a brilliant way for Len to do it.
And this is not a dig. I mean, I've thrown digs before, but, you know, Roy Thomas style would be to put everyone in the room and put a little name tag on them. Yeah. And I like this way better. So.
Yeah. And a lot of word balloons.
Yeah.
With a lot of words and historical facts.
Right, exactly. Educational. Educational.
Roy Thomas fans, no angry emails, please. Thank you. Roy, we owe Roy an amazing, incredible, huge, immense, you know, debt. He, you know, literally single-handedly saved this team for us.
Absolutely. Yeah, without All-Star Squadron, we wouldn't be here talking about this. No doubt about it.
And Last Days.
Yeah. So Kiku Thunder, real quick. I love the idea of Kiku Thunder and Jesse Quick. I love that Straczynski is trying to set the stage for the JSA legacy, right? I mean, we had it with Infinity Inc. in the 80s, but here we are in the 90s, and he's trying to establish some more legacy characters. And, you know, it's something that's obviously JSA legacy is something that they become known for. So that here he's just trying to add to that tapestry. And I love that. And it's a shame that Kiku never gets used after this series, right? She appears in a couple of pages of Primal Force. And while I like Primal Force, that is not a good use of Kiku in that series. And so it's a shame.
Nor the Red Tornado.
We'll have to talk about that another day, because there's some pros and cons to that, actually.
Oh, okay. You remember Johnny's son, don't you?
Well, that was in Primal Force, right?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And that better, less forgotten, I would think, but at least those issues. All right. So talk about the diner here. So how much fun is the diner? Come on.
Well, I like it because we get even more stuff from Charles.
Right.
And the funny little thing about you should have that checked, you know, he's talking to the kid about the mole on his face. You know. I love it because there's so much lead up to getting him in costume.
Yes.
That he's going, come on, let's get him in costume.
And when he does, dang, that panel. I posted it on social media just last night, getting ready for this. That panel of Dr. Midnight, it deserved a full-page splash. I'm sorry. It's so amazing.
It really, really did. I'm almost surprised Mike kept it as kind of small, you know, as he did. It really, really needed to be bigger because I love Dr. Midnight's outfit.
And this is one of those examples where he didn't change the costume. He didn't even really necessarily tweak it. It's just when it's in Perelbeck's hands, it looks so boss. Like, when I read this in 1992, it made me want to cosplay as Dr. Midnight. I had never wanted to cosplay as anyone before that. I have never wanted to cosplay as anyone after that. I, at some point in my life, it's probably never going to happen, but I would like to cosplay as Perelbeck's Dr. Midnight. It looks that cool. It looks that amazing.
Yeah. Love it, love it, love it. It's too bad that you really only get that one shot of his boots, and that's where Wildcat's kind of holding his cup in his palms to get Doc mm-hmm. to jump into his hand so he can, you know, throw him over the thing or whatever. I wish it was a full length shot, but I'm not gonna say anything bad about it because I do love it so much. Wow. And look, a bunch of red. See, there could have been a complaint about too much red on this team here.
You know? You got a bug about the coloring, man. Jeez.
I know, really.
So it is interesting with this mission, and I didn't realize this until I was writing up my notes, they did pick the three non-powered JSA members for the mission. Now, to be fair, they are pretty amazing. It is just supposed to be recon, but, you know, they send the Atom on a recon mission, and Atom doesn't do anything subtle, right? Oh, you know what? I'm surprised you didn't bring up from a coloring thing, because this did get addressed by Glenn Whitmore in that thread. Al's supposed to have red hair, but now Parabek drew him with black and white hair, you know, like black hair that's turned to white. And so that wasn't even Glenn Whitmore because it was right there in the ink. So that's one thing that they did where they changed his hair color.
Yeah. I don't especially care for the bald and mustache look.
Really?
It might even be the mustache a lot that, yeah, I never really cared for it. I wouldn't have minded if he was balding, but you could still see the red.
Okay.
Yeah.
In hindsight, I wish it had, and I didn't even remember the red hair until someone mentioned it. I'm like, oh yeah, of course. So I wish it did have a red tint, but I'm in love with that mustache. Like, I want to just hug that mustache. It is such a manly man, cool old guy mustache that I just love. Love it.
And he looks and acts like such a curmudgeon, you know, but it's kind of funny. It gives the guy more character than he's ever really had before that.
Yeah.
And kind of almost all these guys, you know, what I really liked is that Len kind of pulled Wildcat out of his 70s era.
Right.
You know, where in the revived All-Star comics, you know, he was all, you know, use guys and this and that, you know, and I never really cared much for like that. This is like pulling back from that, I think. Sure, he's a boxer, but he's not an idiot,
right,
you know.
Right.
He's not a goon, unless you're going to explain that he has pugilistic dementia, you know, that he's taking too many hits to the head or like that. But I love that you brought up and pointed out that you got the mystery men going on this covert, you know, mission. I just love that. Wildcat, Dr. Midnight, Mr. Terrific, those are the characters that really cemented my love for the Mystery Men characters. Again, Batman is my most favorite fictional character of all time. You know, it's not to say I don't love any of the characters with powers, but this is, to me, the core of the JSA. You can say it's Jay and Alan, and I love them too, but not in the same way that I love these guys who all they have is a costume and they're two fists,
right?
You know,
there's a lot to love for these guys. I just adore it. Now they also have a little fun with that here, where, because, you know, like we saw Atom and Wildcat taking turns changing costumes in the diner. You know, here Dr. Midnight has to change costumes in the back seat of the car, and as an older guy myself, I can attest that changing clothes in a car is not fun when you get to be a certain age. So I love that you're getting the Mystery Men aspect, but they're also like a little tongue-in-cheek reminding us, hey, these guys are older, okay, and so they're having fun with it, and I dig that. But going back to your issue, yes, to me, I see the JSA sort of compartmentalized between the Mystery Men and the gods, and they're on the same team. You know, you got the Spectre, Dr. Fate, Green Lantern.
Hand of God.
Right, exactly. But in my mind, it's perfectly fine that the Spectre is sitting down and having a meal with Al Pratt. You know, that perfectly fine. I don't see any issue with that. And I love that about this team.
Yeah. There's an interesting juxtaposition in, I think it's the current issue of Mark Waid's World's Finest comic, that the JSA is guest starring in it right now, and the Spectre is there. And you remember that the Spectre was in the Justice Society. You know, like, how did this literal ghost hand of God, you know, why did he like waste his time with these guys that most of them had no powers at all, and some had powers that would have been just puny compared to him?
Mm.
It's a real interesting reminder of that juxtaposition.
I'm a few issues behind on World's Finest. I can't wait to get there, though.
I'm glad that they didn't bring the Spectre into this book. I don't know if Len had, you know, plans. I don't know if anybody's really ever asked him.
So 1992, the year this is published, is the same year the Ostrander Mandrake Spectre series started.
Okay, that's right.
So really, you, having them together wouldn't make any sense because of the level of the stories they were telling. But, you know, it's all part of the team, though. It all works.
Yep.
So a couple different things. Again, Dr. Midnight, they do play, like you mentioned, they made the joke about what he could see and what he couldn't see. They do play, again, with your knowledge. They don't explain Dr. Midnight's blindness. Sometimes they mention he's kind of blind. Sometimes he doesn't seem to be. So you either got to know it or you just go with the flow of it. And then Dr. Midnight, it looks like he whips out a gun and is just straight up shooting these animal hybrids.
No, that's the cryotuber.
Well, they mentioned that. Is that a classic era device that I just don't remember?
I think it's a controversial thing. The cryotuber was something that they brought in one of the 60s JLA-JSA crossover stories.
Okay.
Around the time of the Batman TV series, so around, you know, 66. And it was a way to get these two-fisted costume-wearing Mystery Men characters, it elevated them a little bit above that.
Okay.
They gave Dr. Midnight something called the cryotuber, which is a really weird thing. It was supposed to be more or less like a freeze gun kind of a thing.
Okay.
And then they gave Sandman this really... He had a device that I think... help me on this. I think he threw sand up in the air and then shot a ray at it and he could form it into objects.
I have no clue. That is foreign to me.
I've seen a lot of, you know, readers and fans even of the JSA really mock that moment in time because, again, these were characters that didn't need stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
It was the gimmick era. It was the era of the Adam West TV series. It was the era of no matter what comic Batman was in, he was the star. You know, that was what was going on in Justice League at that time. So they were all being given these really silly devices. Thank God Wildcat didn't give him anything. He was just literally a boxer in a costume, you know, which is fine with me. But that's why I laughed when I saw this again. I went, oh, yeah, the cryotuber, although they don't call it that because that's a really stupid name.
He calls it a cryo device, though. Ultra Humanite remembers it.
Yeah, Len didn't want to say tuber. And why the hell it was, you know, a tuber is like a root that you dig up out of the ground.
Right.
Yeah, it was the dumbest name. You know what? Now I got to go and dig up that story and relook at it because I want to try to remember exactly what that Sandman device was.
Oh my gosh.
Stupid, whatever it was. It's like, he doesn't need that. Stop it. He has the wire poon and the gas gun.
Oh, the wire poon. The most unfortunately named device ever.
I know, right? So, it's worse than cryotuber.
Right. So I got a question here, and I don't know if
and then Cosmic Rod.
I know.
Like the JSA, we have the worst named devices of all.
There's a bunch of them. All right. I'm moving away from this. I'm running away quickly. So I don't know whether I'm showing my JSA ignorance here. Or it's one of those, you know, like Sandman's weird sand devices. Or the Ultra Humanite stuttering, is that a thing? Because I don't remember that at
all. It's a Len Strazewski thing, yeah.
Okay,
I think it's explained as we go along.
Okay.
If I remember, I think it's something like it wasn't like his new body, he wasn't gelled with it well enough, maybe. It was something to do with that.
Yeah, and I guess we'll find out next issue then. But it's not a reoccurring thing, though. Like, it's not something that I just forgot about that was in a 1960s comic or something like that, then.
No.
Okay.
No, people can call me on that and correct me on that, but no, I don't believe so.
Believe me, these nerds will. They will call you on it.
You know, I mean, after reading comics for, you know, more than 50 years now, I'm sure there's plenty of things that I've forgotten.
Well, heck, I called it Sandstorm earlier, or Sandblast when I meant to say Sandstorm. Clearly, we all forget stuff after a while. So,
you know what? That provided us with such an amusing moment.
It was fun. It was fun. Since we are talking about coloring, I told you all I'd play fair, and if I see something, I'm going to call it out. And so I've got something here on the coloring side I feel like I need to mention. Dr. Louisa Sulles, who is Dr. Midnight's partner at the clinic, she is colored in this comic with a kind of a magenta skin tone. And Kiku will be colored with that same skin tone in later issues, not this one, but in this one. And when you look in the printed comic, you know, that 1990s newsprint paper, it absorbs ink a lot. So that skin tone actually is kind of subtle. It's not in your face. Unfortunately, when you read it digitally and there's no newsprint sucking up that ink, the skin tone is super noticeable. I get what the colorist was going for sure. But with the digital version, it just unfortunately does it no favors. And I imagine that probably wouldn't go down very well with audiences today. So just observing it.
I gotta tell you, looking at the newsprint copy, it doesn't look good, actually. It's
okay.
Very...
Oh, I see some pages, yeah.
Purplish. It's page 13.
Yep, that's the one I just landed on.
And then, sadly enough, I mean, this is, what is this, 1992? You would have thought we would have maybe grown past the coloring of, like, Asian or South Seas characters, but Kiku is given the coloring of Pie Face.
Yeah, there's a little bit of, yeah.
It's very interesting. I love Mike's drawing of her at the bottom of page 16 when she says, excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a little bit of unfortunate, you know, coloring.
Yeah.
And I don't remember if that continued.
Kiku picks up the magenta color later. So,
okay.
Again,
okay.
Folks, I said I'd call it out and yeah. I don't want to dwell on it. So we'll just move on there. I do have another question. I don't know if it's a gripe or not. I'm going to play coincidence police here, which is there's a lot of coincidences in this series so far. Like, you know, the Ultragen offices are across the street from Alan Scott's old TV station in the previous issue. You know, Johnny Quick has history with Ultragen and is there at the right moment to talk about it. Dr. Midnight shows up right moment with the Ultragen intel. You know, Johnny Thunder shows up at the McNider clinic late at night exactly at the right moment to face off against Ultragen. It's just a lot of coincidences going on here. Now, if all these coincidences turn out to be orchestrated by the Ultra Humanite on purpose to, like, specifically target the JSA, then it's all fine and no worries. And also, I mean, I realize, come on, this is comic book superhero fiction. It is completely dependent upon coincidences, so I shouldn't really be complaining. But it is, I promised you guys if I see something, I'll call it out. So there we done. I've called it out.
Okay.
All right.
It's funny. It's stuff that, you know, I mean, maybe back then that would never have occurred to me. I was literally just absorbing every page of
the
series. Like, oh my God. Oh my God. Oh, look. Oh my God.
Right. And those two little nitpicks are nothing in the scheme of how gorgeous and amazing this issue is. So don't walk away going, oh, well, here's some stuff not to like. No, think about the amazing paperback art. Think about Straczynski layering in JSA history, layering in All-Star Squadron history, layering characters slowly introducing legacies. This book is a beauty to behold.
I wish I could say that about the last page.
Uh-oh. Okay, talk to me.
Yeah, Mike let me down on that last page, and I totally forgotten this. I remember how disappointed I was back then, and I'm still now. Final page, big splash page, Ultra Humanite reveal. The bottom half of the page is gorgeous.
Okay.
The top half of the page, that creature is like straight out of a Dr. Seuss book.
Okay.
In my opinion. And the drawing of the Ultra Humanite himself is very, very awkward.
Oh, really? I like it. Yeah, I like his new look.
And his torso are there's something really, really off. But it's really the horse thing that I've always hated. It to me, that was Mike at his most cartoony.
I'll agree with that, yeah.
It doesn't to me fit in with the rest of the page. Midnight, Adam, especially Wildcat, gorgeous. To me, that echoes the cover, that those you're getting those dramatic shots. And again, I can't argue, Wildcat's huge there. He looks great, you know, in that. But I always thought that horse thing was so disappointing to me because it's like he drew it very quickly and it's very one-dimensional too.
It looks like a mixture of like, because it's supposed to be animal hybrid, so it looks like it's a hybrid of like a horse, an antelope, and a kangaroo or something maybe. And it's very very fantasy based. It really is.
Yes, and that's what it is. It's not one of Mike's best drawings. It's not one of his best designs. And for one thing, it, you know, we said deceptively simple. I said that or whatever, and I think it's too simple. Maybe it could have used used. I don't know, some more fleshing out, some more detail, whatever. And then again, there's something about the Ultra Humanite, his entire torso from groin all the way up. It's that angle, the way he's leaning back.
Mm-hmm.
There's something that doesn't look right about it. I don't want to say it's like Rob Liefeld bad, you know, but to me it was never that good. And it kind of really back then and still now, it diminished the impact of that reveal.
I totally get what you're laying down about the creature. I'm there with you. But I don't see it on Ultra Humanite. And I can tell you what, folks, I'll put this page out there in the gallery. You guys let us know what you think of the Ultra. I mean, again, the creature's very fantasy cartoony, but I wasn't even looking at it. I was too excited going, ooh, Ultra Humanite that doesn't look like a stupid ape. I love this. So I was excited for that.
No, I like the ape.
I love it, too.
The big white ape with the big head and the red, you know, gladiator thing or whatever that he's wearing. You know what? I mean, I'll let go of the Ultra Humanite drawing and say it's that horse thing. That's just not good. And especially after the lead up to it, the wonderful sequences throughout the arrival of our heroes, the appearance of Dr. Midnight, the way they get into the compound, the meeting with the other creatures, which look great, you know, and then, like I said, he lets me down with that horse thing.
All right. Fair enough. You're going to die on that hill. That and a green cowl.
In the last panel of the penultimate page, page 21, that creature looks so much better at the bottom there with the shadows. That's what it needed. See, it's so stark and cartoony there, you know?
Yeah, no, you're not wrong.
All right. I say no more. I will say no more, Squire.
Cartoony horses and green cowls. Those are the hills you're going to die on. Got it. All right. Well, now...
That's what Jim Beard hates.
That's what you're going to be remembered for. So, and now it is time for the All-Star Award. This is where we nominate our favorite moment from the issue, whether it's be a story beat, something in the art, something that made us laugh, you know, whatever. Both myself and Jim are going to pick one moment each to spotlight, and those both will earn the All-Star Award. Jim, you're the guest, which is, you know, quite frankly, been unfortunate for me, but whatever. What?
Okay, whatever. Who asked who to be on? I think it was me. I begged, and
Not even. I'm thrilled to have you here. I'm just giving you a hard time.
The hoops that I had to jump through, man.
Hey, I set the green room up like you asked. You gave that long list of like 42 things you had to have in the green room, and you got every single one.
You had the dancers dressed like the Golden Age Red Tornado. I appreciate that. And
that was not easy to do, by the way. I just want to point out. Do you know how many metal pots I had to cut eye holes in? So what? Back to the point, what is your pick for the All-Star Award, Jim? And I know it's not the horse at the end.
No. Yeah, it is. I was lying all along. It's the horse at the end. It's the horse you rode in on, buddy.
Oh, my God.
it's absolutely page 19, panel 1, 2, and follow the arrows. Those very nice arrows.
Mm-hmm.
Panel 3. So it's both moment and art. It's the Dr. Midnight in costume reveal. Only slightly diminished by that word balloon and his thought, I wish Len would not have gone so far as to say that he was embarrassed.
Okay. Well, I will say the show is only 3 or 4 episodes long, and this is the first time that me and my guest have picked the exact same All-Star Award.
I knew you were going to pick it.
Well, I kind of led with it by putting it on Facebook last night, but I like the line because, I mean, let's face it, the costume looks amazing to us, right? But Charles, Chuck, whatever you want to call him, has been dealing with this costume for 50 years at this point? Mm-hmm. So he's probably a little over it. Even though it does look boss to us, he's probably like, all right, you know, I'm 70 years old now. I do feel ridiculous in this thing, but he shows he's got the moves. So I'm okay with the line.
And then he vaults over the wall.
Yes, he's so cool.
Yeah, I know. He is. He's very cool.
Yeah.
I wish it would have been one of the characters that it would have seemed a little bit more believable coming from. You know, know, as much as I love it, there's reasons to kind of pick apart Alan Scott's weird ass costume, you know.
Well, sure, the pirate shirt and all that, but who cares?
You know, the banded, you know, boots, that mm-hmm. the whole thing, the opera cape, you know, and all of that. I mean, Ted Grant could have finally wised up and said, "Why am I running around in a skin tight cat suit?"
Well, it's got to be, now that we know it's hairy, it's got to be hot too, right?
It's a, what do they call that? A hair suit.
Right.
A hair shirt. That was a thing.
It was, exactly right.
You know what I mean? You know what it is, though? It's because of how much I love Dr. Midnight, how much I love the outfit, how much I love the character. It's you don't want your hero to say they don't like something that you love, you know? And that's just a little bit of it. But it, I mean, here I'm picking this moment, I'm picking that artwork. So it's actually, stepping back from it, it is actually an interesting take. Len really did try to make sure everybody had a distinctive personality.
Mm-hmm.
And what he decided for Charles was, I'm not that happy, you know?
No, that's fair.
Things are a little grim. I came back to a world, you know, and the clinic where things are more serious.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of like that take on it. I mean, even Al's edge is very interesting. You know, they could very easily have given that to Ted, you know, but he didn't. So I love it. I love that he has his medical bag.
Yes.
No matter what, and you pointed it out, and kudos to you for that, he's still a doctor. At the end of the day, his name is Dr. Midnight.
As Black Canary pointed out in the JSA series in the 90s, you know, there's not a lot of doctors, superheroes, that are actually medical doctors. So, yeah. Yep. Well, congratulations to the Parabek-drawn Dr. Midnight. You have won the coveted All-Star Award. Yeah, please wear it with pride. It is as tangible as our love for that moment.
Is it fungible, though?
Right. Now, Jim, I need to ask a favor. Would you mind hanging out here for a bit at the spooky Ultragen compound for just a little while and keeping an eye on the Ultrahumanite? I need to go read the listener feedback. I want to make sure he doesn't start rapping any of DJ Rubber Ducky's tunes. Do you mind hanging out here for a minute?
Yeah, as long as I don't have to have anything to do with that horse.
That sounds good. Now, don't worry, Jim. We will bring you back at the end of the show. But after this podcast promo break, folks, I'm going to read your listener feedback in a segment called The Society Pages. The Society Pages. All right, here we go. So the Society Pages is the segment of the show where we cover your feedback from the previous episode. And of course, the name Society Pages is taken from the letter column title of this JSA series. Now, earlier this episode, Jim and I were talking about our favorite JSA costume redesigns. Well, I want to hear yours. So share them in the comment thread. Again, it can be a character who redesigned their own costume, or maybe it's the redesign of a legacy character, whatever you want to do. And don't feel you have to limit yourself to this series. Now, don't forget to go to your local comic shop to pick up JSA number 1, which is on the shelves now by Jeff Lemire and Diego Olortigue. I probably said that wrong, so I'm terribly sorry. But the issue is out. Now, full disclosure for myself, I'm a DC Infinite Ultra subscriber. That's the digital subscription service. So DC gets my money, but it means that I get my new DC books a month after they hit the shelves. So I'll definitely be following along, but I'll be 1 month behind the newsstand, folks. On the action figure front, you know those new Superpower 3 packs I talked about last time, featuring JSA's Green Lantern, Starman, and Hour Man, they have been shipped by some retailers. A good buddy of mine showed me his figures at his house, and they are amazing. I'm still waiting on my own shipment, but I can't wait to get them. Also, at a recent convention, they announced a Jay Garrick Flash figure will be released in the Superpowers line for spring 2025, and there is a larger scale McFarlane figure of Wildcat to come out as well. In my own action figure news, I recently picked up that old Mattel DC Universe Classics figure of Commander Steel, and he's happily hanging out with my JSA figures now. I also, by the way, at Target just the other day, I saw the new Commander Steel action figure from the McFarlane line, and it looks pretty sweet. One last thing for our Patreon supporters of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. There is a new poll over on our Patreon to vote for who is the greatest individual foe of the JSA. Now, at the time of this recording, Ultra Humanite, Vandal Savage, and Perdegaton are all within just a few votes of each other. So get out there. There's a ton of options. You can also put your thoughts in the comments. So the poll is open through December to our Patreon supporters. So be sure to vote today. Now, remember, folks, get out on the social media, be part of the conversation. You can find us on most of the platforms as JSA Presents. And most importantly, leave your comments on our website. And as I always say, it's about building a community of online JSA fans around the show. All right, first up, we're going to read the iTunes or Apple Podcast reviews. Got to ask you, if you haven't left a review yet, please consider it. It really does help raise the profile of the show and attract new listeners. All you got to do is look on iTunes or Apple Podcasts for Justice Society Presents. And if you're outside the United States and leave me a review, please let me know, because I won't see those iTunes or Apple Podcast reviews unless I filter to that specific country. And as a thank you, when you leave these reviews, I will read your entire iTunes Apple Podcast review on the air, just like this one from David Gallagher. David is, of course, the writer of Only Living Girl, High Moon, all kinds of different comic books and video games. So David writes, a captivating journey into DC's golden age. He writes, Justice Society Presents is an explosive podcast that dives deep into the untold history of the DC universe, shining a light on the legendary Justice Society of America. Each episode pulls back the curtain on these iconic characters and their monumental impact, serving up insightful commentary that reflects a passionate love for the source material. Whether you're a diehard comic book fan or just starting to explore this vast universe, Justice Society Presents reveals the heroes who forged the path for future generations. If you want to understand the true essence of DC Comics, this podcast is an essential listen. It's time to uncover the truth behind the legends. Wow. Thank you so much, David. That means the world to me. I really appreciate that. Folks, remember, look on iTunes or Apple Podcasts for Justice Society Presents and leave your review, and it will get read here on the air as well. All right. So I have collected all of your comments from our website, for social media, things like that. I put it all in a Google document, and it is so many pages. So obviously, I can't read every word. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to acknowledge every single person that left a comment on the website and read a portion of their comments. And these are covering Justice Society of America number 2 from 1992 with my guest, Sean Ross. First up is Stephen Shend. I apologize, Stephen, if I said your last name wrong. He says, I'm enjoying the heck out of your Justice Society podcast. I'm being reminded of my love for Parabuck's art and saddened he was gone so soon. I, too, have that promo poster signed by both the writer and artist from a long-ago Chicago Comic-Con. I need to get a reframe soon. Anywho, glad I can thank you for current and past Fire and Water podcasts I've enjoyed the past few years. Aw, well, that's incredibly kind of you to say, Stephen. Thank you so much. Then, now, during the last episode, you may recall, we covered a suggestion from a listener that there might be some gay coding in the friendship between the Atom and Wildcat. Well, Gus Casals chimes in. Gus does the Alfred Pennyworth Presents podcast and his Legion 60 Years Later podcast. So Gus says, well, Al is rocking the dad mustache, or better said, the daddy mustache in gay culture terms. And he has that attitude towards Ted, but I'm not feeling the something else vibes there. That said, I might have read some adult fan fiction style narrations about similar men. I will not develop that idea more in a family-friendly site. Well, thank you, Gus. I appreciate that. Then he says, Mike Parabek drawing Neil Gaiman's Sandman? Now I can't get that idea out of my head. Me either. Then we heard from a new commenter named Dustin, says this is his first time commenting on the Fire and Water website, and he proposes the idea for a storyline called JSA versus the Nazis Again, and he goes into a lot of detail on how much fun that storyline could be, but then he poses the question, which Hawkman was in the JSA at the time during this book? Was this when there was still two Hawkmen, or post-Zero Hour? It's been forever since I've read these things from that era, maybe even not since the era itself. Well, Dustin, I don't even have to answer you, because Tim Price swooped in to save the day. That's Tim Price from the Outcasters, Batman and the Outsiders podcast, and the Batgirl Huntress podcast. Tim says, in JSA number 2's month of publication, meaning the comic we just covered, the Hawkworld ongoing series was on issue 27. So then Tim goes on to explain, yes, there are two Hawkmen at this point. There's the Golden Age Carter Hall, and the new Katar Hall, who debuted in the Prestige Hawkman miniseries. But he says that doesn't last long, since Zero Hour is a year plus away. Thank you, Tim, for saving me the trouble. All right, then we hear from Craig McDonald. Now, last episode, we posed the question, who was your favorite legacy hero that came from the 90s? So Craig says, my favorite legacy character is Wally West, though he became the Flash in the 1980s. Also a fan of Kyle Rayner and Jack Knight, and I know I'm in the minority here, but Black Condor 2, Ryan Kendall, who had a short-lived series in the 1990s and was briefly in the JLA and was killed during Infinite Crisis. Craig, you are not alone there, man. I also dig Ryan Kendall, the Black Condor. I absolutely love the character. I love the way it felt like in the 90s they were building towards a new Freedom Fighters, and it kind of sort of happened in just basically in time for them to wipe him out in Infinite Crisis. But still, I'm right there with you, Black Condor. You're not alone, my friend. Now, we're from Brian Schufo, says, I'm really enjoying reading again about the heroes who are, hopefully, older than we are. I'm still recovering from the day I realized I was older than Superman and Batman's apparent ages. Then he says, it took me a long time to understand the comments about the Atom's new costume. It looks so familiar, until I realized it was a really well-designed mashup of his original full mask and later Red Crescent versions. A retro update that just works. Yeah, Brian, it's such a great costume, as me and Jim talked about earlier. Then we're from Michael Kramer. Now, remember last episode we joked about that the JSA invented Zoom conference calling. So Michael Kramer says, I think the Super Friends invented video calls in the 70s because they were having Zooms with all sort of officials and interplanetary heads, and even the Legion of Doom. Then he says, oh, wait, no, my bad. They had video calls on Star Trek in the 1960s. Although that was set in the far future, and the Super Friends wasn't considered part of the new semi-rigid continuity at the time. Ah, my head hurts. I guess the DCU had video calls as a general thing long before the real-life technology caught up to it. Yeah, you're dead on there, Michael. Thank you. Then we heard from our buddy Gene Hendricks, who's a voice actor. Gene says, wow, favorite 1990s legacy hero? That's a tough one. I'm going to limit myself to a character that was introduced in the 90s, which eliminates Wally West, which was 1986, becoming The Flash, and Tim Drake, 1989. So he says, Kyle Rayner is certainly up there, but I think I would have to say John Henry Irons edges him out. Steel takes the legacy of Superman and goes more towards Iron Man, but still upholding the ideals of the original. Wow, that is a great point about John Henry Irons. He's a fantastic legacy character. And fair call on Tim Drake premiering in 89 and Wally West taking the mantle much earlier. I just was mentioning them because I felt like they came to prominence in the 90s. But yes, John Henry, that is a great one. So good call. Then Super Captain chimes in and says, after a little thought, my two favorite legacy characters from the 90s would be Connor Hawke as Green Arrow and Courtney Whitmore. Courtney is just eligible, having debuted in 1999. That is also a great pick, Super Captain. Well done. Then we heard from Chris Franklin for the Firewater Podcast Network. He has shows such as JLUcast, Superman Movie Minute, and more. This is great discussion, guys. I remember being a little surprised to see Al was mostly bald, had a mustache, and was the grouchy one in the Ted-Al combo here. I remember Al having pretty good head of strawberry blonde hair, but who knows what eons and Ragnarok could do to you. Either way, once I got past that, I liked that Al looked like someone's old, back-in-my-day uncle. And then he says, I think this is the first time Carter Hall wasn't the team leader of the JSA. That was one hell of a long run. But now, retroactively, I think a lot due to Robinson's golden age, we tend to think of Alan Scott as the big guy, with the absence of the Earth 2 Superman, and therefore him being the leader just makes sense. Yeah, that's a good point, Chris. Yeah, I mean, a lot of times I do think of Alan Scott as the big gun sort of thing, so making him leader just makes sense. But yeah, Hawkman absolutely had the job forever. Huh, okay. Then Chris says his favorite legacy hero of the 90s, hands down, is Jack Knight. And then Chris chimes in about, again, our Justice Society Presents podcast feed. He says, I'm sorry to all the podcast listeners for Cindy and I dropping the ball on keeping up on our long-abandoned Starman Chronicles series, which was supposed to migrate from Supermates to here on Justice Society Presents. But yes, Starman is not an easy show to podcast about. It's so dense, it takes a lot of work just to get through a single issue and break it down. Much easier to talk about animated Justice League adventures, I also love. Now, Chris, don't feel bad, man. That show is incredible. All the episodes you created are still out there, folks. If you want to listen to some fantastic coverage of the Starman James Robinson series, go to the Fire and Water Podcast Network, go to the Supermates Podcast, and all the old Starman Chronicles episodes are there. They're absolutely fantastic. Chris and Cindy do a fantastic job on it. I believe they did get one episode out on Justice Society Presents. So anyway, check all of those out. It is well worth your time, folks. They were from Captain Entropy, who says, my favorite 90s legacy hero? As Gene pointed out, John Henry Irons is awesome, but Connor Hawke had that great story where he's joining the Morrison JLA and had to go up against the Key solo with Trick Arrows. Let's call it a tie between Steel and the Junior Green Arrow. Hey, that works. That absolutely works. They were from Rob McCarthy, author of the book The Star, The Space Princesses, and Other Stories. Rob says, I had no idea Al Pratt was Tank Punch strong. I thought he was Batman strong. Well, actually, Rob, originally he was just sort of Batman strong, but then Al eventually ends up with this atomic punch where he can, you know, really do a lot of damage like he did here in the comic. And I can't remember where it first appeared, but it was really detailed heavily in the All-Star Squadron comics. Then we heard from Justin Steiner from the Shoe Fly Pie Substack. He says, I was surprised at how curmudgeonly Al was, especially since you think that would be Ted. Goes to show how characterizations change over time. It does make me wish Ted now had opened that gym together, as it clearly would have been lent a different dynamic to hero training. Yeah, that would have been interesting. I agree. Then he says, as far as 90s legacy characters, he talks a little bit about how Wally was one of his favorites, but he considers that a 1980s character. Connor Hawke is an honorable mention, but my favorite legacy DC hero is Jack Knight. Starman was my favorite comic in the 90s, and there was a lot of great DC comics during that decade. Great picks, Justin. Absolutely great picks. Then from Bucky749, aka the American Samurai, who has his own YouTube channel, he says, how powerful is the Golden Age Adam? Did we ever get a measure of his strength? Because he may have to hold back when dealing with normal thugs. Well, Bucky, I'm going to do my best to quantify it here. I don't know that we ever found out exactly how strong Al is, and I'm not even sure if it's strength or just like damage he can inflict, because it's more like probably the Iron Fist kind of thing, where like a normal hit's a normal hit, but he has to focus all the energy into his fist, and then he can give this like atomic punch. So I think it's a matter of focusing that energy in order to do that kind of damage. Then we heard from Liz Ann Oswald, who has her own YouTube channel. Liz says, the JSA. I like the Johns run, but miss this one. But the art style reminds me of Impact Comics from the Archie/DC run. Well, Liz, there's a good reason for that. Because Mike Parabak drew a whole bunch of the Impact comics. So there's a very good reason that it reminds you of that. Then from Matthew Davis, who says, Wally West was one of my favorite legacy heroes. Maybe he's been around since the 1960s, but he really hit his stride in the 90s. Also, can't forget Courtney Whitmore, a legacy hero who got her own TV series. Yeah, great, absolutely great picks, Matthew. Then Matthew says, I wonder if Al's standoff with a tank was inspired by a real-world instance a few years before in Tiananmen Square. Wow, Matthew. That could be. That would be pretty powerful in commentary, if it was. But I think another commenter, Michael Salko, may have actually tracked it down. He pointed out that the Atom in the Tank, could it be a callback to All-Star Squadron number 19? Or is it a coincidence? Because there is some panels he shared in All-Star Squadron number 19 where Al Pratt's literally facing off against a tank. So if it is an homage, it's a good chance it's to All-Star Squadron number 19. Then we heard from Tim Price again from the Outcasters Batman and the Outsiders podcast and the Batgirl Huntress podcast. Tim says, this is my favorite version of Al Pratt's costume. The full-length pants, the full face mask, and no cape. It works for me. And his characterization in this series is excellent. All the heroes are wondering if getting back into action is a good idea, but Al being the contrary voice makes him stand out because he cares about his friends. Yes, he says, I want to be dignified, but I'm getting the vibe of him feeling protective of the whole group. That point is driven home by him stopping the tank single atomic-handedly. Oh, so good. And did anyone else get a Golden Age Superman feeling from that splash page? You know, I didn't even think about that, Tim, but that's a great point. The smashing and Golden Age Superman, there might be something there. Then he says, a little note to Alan Scott's baldness. It was revealed in Infinity Inc. Annual Number 1. Near the end of that issue, Alan confesses that he's been wearing a toupee. Maybe being in the television industry made him self-conscious. And then Tim says, the costume changes for Adam and Hawkman highlight how stinking great Parabak was. He's already a great storyteller, but he has an amazing flair for costume design, keeping classic iconic elements, but revisions that make them feel fresh and like respectful improvements. I just love it so much. Then we heard from Symbol Pending, who has the Power Girl blog called Symbol Pending. Says, the whole Ted and Al thing is a reminder of how that until recently, we were so starved of gay representation that any close friendship were grasped upon as a couple. At least we have Alan Scott now, who has, to me, always been gay, having come to the character through the Earth 2 counterpart. Thanks for sharing that, Symbol Pending. Then we heard from my buddy Jose Rivera, author of The Underground Adventures, who says, I really dig the Adam's new costume. It has elements of his previous suit with a little bit of Cyclotron thrown in. Interesting enough, it kind of informs how what's Adam's Smasher and Damage would wear down the line. The whole subsection of heroes can be tied together with this suit. Yeah, absolutely, Jose, as we detailed earlier, totally right there with you. Then heard from Diablo Frank from the Roll Spine Podcasting Network. He has shows such as Terminator Now podcast, and he's my co-host on the Blue Devil episodes of Once Upon a Geek and more. Now, first off, I want to say, folks, I love Diablo Frank. He and I are good friends. We have shared meals together. We're good buddies. But boy, he went off the rails in the comments this time. He is just a grumpy grump. So I am just going to pick out a few comments here, but they are all worth reading. Go out to our website. They're a lot of fun. I mean, the dude makes me laugh. But here's some particular ones that are worth saying. It says, the banter between the characters is painful. I just wish they talked more old-timey, calling people cads or skinflints or whatever. Jay Garrick doing a Kevin McAllister from Home Alone while Alan drops the shades meme makes me want to vomit neuron green. Thank you, Frank. Then he goes on to say, this is the second straight issue of JSAers making a case for why there should not be a JSA, at least not one made above AARP members. I've always agreed, preferring it to be a multi-generational, like, you know, a society. Hey, I'm right there with you, Frank. The eventual JSA we got in the 90s is fantastic for that aspect, but this is what we had to work with, so, and I love the book, so. Then he goes on, the 60s look a lot different half again on Tom Cruise, Brad Pitt, Wesley Snipes, Keanu Reeves, Eddie Murphy, Antonio Banderas, Nicolas Cage, John Leguizamo, Johnny Depp, Digimon Hansu, and Rob Lowe are all in their 60s, and I wouldn't bet on myself against any of them. Yeah, totally. Yeah, the 60s look very different than they used to. You know, I made the Jack LaLanne joke in a previous episode, but yeah, these guys, I would not want to mess with any of those dudes. Then we heard from my buddy DC Dave, who says, throwing in my two cents into the what I would like to see for the JSA today discussion that started last comments episode. Give me a World War II JSA book, please. Think of the All-Star Squadron using a modern take on the writing, but takes place in the 1940s. Give me the JSA in their prime. Give me a storytelling from today, especially with the modern takes we have on these characters. And I'm looking at you, Alan Scott, and the reincarnations of Carter Hall. I suppose if that's not large enough, you could do the All-Stars, but I feel like that's too big. But that got me thinking, All-Star Squadron is Justice Society Unlimited, isn't it? You know, that's a great observation, Dave. It is kind of Justice Society Unlimited, huh? There from Michael Bailey from the Fortress of Bailey 2. It all comes back to Superman, the Overlooked Dark Knight, and much more. Mike says, I would like to add my voice in Sean's recommending that Alan Scott Green Lantern series. It's so good. I love the Flash and the Sandman books, but the GL series was definitely the best. The way Alan's sexuality was explored and was handled so well, and the whole thing with the Red Lantern was just great. Red Lantern is one of those should-have-had-a-V8 moments in terms of giving Alan a Sinestro-type villain, but the twist made it so much more heartbreaking. Right there with you, Mike. That series is absolutely great. And by the way, those of you who were clamoring for a modern-day series in the 1940s, go read the Alan Scott Green Lantern series. That's exactly what that book was. Now, it's not the whole team, it's just Alan, but it's well worth your time. Then heard from David Steele from the Earth 2 podcast. In the Power 3 Doctor Who podcast, he says, great discussion on Adam and Wildcat's relationship. For me, that's one of the most memorable aspects of the series. I love the Adam's characterization especially. We also heard from Matt Thuma Lambros. Now, last episode, my guest Sean Ross took some shots at Hector Hall. Well, Matt says, Hector Hall forever. So there we go. We did find our Hector Hall fans. Then we heard from Andrew R., the redheaded fanboy. He says, think I'm going to save some cash and swap out my old ratty used bookstore JSA trades with the new compendiums. But catching up on all 18 episodes of Justice Society Presents is making me really want to do my rereads. Aw, well, I'm honored if we inspired a reread of any sort. Then we heard from Joey Hoffman, who says, just started listening to the episode. Shag never needs to apologize for the length of the episode. The more, the better in my book. Aw, well, thank you, Joey. And this episode is a little bit longer because Jim and I had so much fun stuff to talk about, so I hope you enjoy. Heard from Adam Crouch, who says, I saw some of the original pages from this issue for sale at Comic-Con. I wish I'd been able to grab a picture for you. Well, Adam, first off, oh, thank you for thinking of me, but more importantly, how incredible is that you got to see original paperback pages? That is so awesome, buddy. I hope you got to really just drink that in and enjoy it. Then heard from my buddy J. David Weider, who's part of the Bat Pod and formerly of Dave's Daredevil podcast. Dave says, just finished this excellent episode. The show is my new audio comfort food. A lot of mentions about the cover to issue number one looking like FF number one, but Brave and the Bold number 28 preceded FF number one, and they are some striking similarities. Wow, Dave, that's fantastic. I cannot believe I never thought in all these years to compare Brave and the Bold number 28 and FF number one as covers. That blows my mind. So great observation. Then John Stibe gave us a shout out. He says, not only am I recommending you check out the latest JSA in the 90s podcast, but I've already listened to it and it's great. Seriously, give it a listen and you'll have as much fun as I did. I'm listening to a lot more content on the site and it's a lot of fun. Thanks for all your hard work. Aw, well, John, thank you so much for listening. Thanks for helping promote the show. Speaking of people who help promote the show, this is the part of the episode where I thank everyone who shared our show on their social media timeline. So I'm talking about Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Threads, Blue Sky. It's a long list of names. I know that, folks. However, these people showed their support and helped promote the show. So it's really important to me that we recognize these individuals. Because, I mean, for example, Derek Crabb, this is probably the only time he's going to be mentioned in the show, but he's a great guy and he helped promote the show and I appreciate it. This time out, we've got nearly 70 names of people who helped promote the show. And hey, you can get on this list next episode. It's not hard. All you got to do is share on Facebook, retweet on Twitter, or whatever it's called nowadays over on all the different things. Again, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Blue Sky, and Threads. Our thanks go out to A World on Fire, an All-Star Squadron podcast, Alan Boyce, Andre TFG, Barry Reese, Between the Pages blog, Billy Delicious, Brian Schufo, Charlie's Geek Cast, Chris Franklin, Chris Lewis, Coffee and Comics, Craig McDonald, Dan Dougherty, Dave Walker 2814, David Ace Gutierrez, DC Dave, Derek Crabb, Diablo Frank, Ed Moore, Glenn Whitmore, yes, the colorist of this comic, Glenn Whitmore, Gus Casals, Infinity Inc. Forever Tumblr, It's Extremely Uncanny, Jeff Poyer, John Stibe, J.P. Rocha, Justin Steiner, Kichi Baker, Kirk Spencer, Con L, Laurel Mountain Flower, Martin Kogan, Max Romero, Michael Bailey, Michael Kramer, Mo Walker, Nuno Duarte, Paul Hicks, Paul Keehan, Peacebound and Down, a Wonder Woman podcast, Pedro Angosto, Peter Flower, Richard Field, Rob Kelly, Robert Junker, Robin Hood, The Bold Outlaw, Rolled Spine Podcast, S. Matthew Stolte, Scott X, Sean Ross, Silverman on Security, Siskoid, Slangward Scott, Solar Ponds, Sports and Comics, Stop, Let's Team Up, a comic podcast, Symbol Pending, Ted Kilvington at Justice Trek, The Bat Pod, The Earth 2 Podcast, The Old Order Changeth Facebook Group, Tim Price, Trent Lewis, Venkman, Warlock Thanos Podcast, Willie Yarbrough, and Zek Cap Boots. Whew. My thanks to all of you for your support of the JSA in the 90s podcast. Folks, your feedback, seriously, is a critical part of the show. I absolutely love it. This community of JSA fans we're building together is fantastic. Now, if I've forgotten or missed anyone, I am terribly sorry. It is probably the fault of Sean Ross. You know, I do my best to find all the social media comments, but sometimes they do slip through my internet fingers. So please keep those cards and letters coming, folks. And remember that the best place to comment is on our website, which is firewaterpodcast.com/JSA. Leave your comments in the show post there, and your fellow JSA fans can share their thoughts and communicate together with you. Now, you can also find us again on all the other social media platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Blue Sky, and Threads. Or you can email us at justicesocietypresents@gmail.com. My thanks again to you listeners for such a great collection of feedback. Now, we're going to take a quick podcast promo break. When we come back, we'll see if this episode's guest, Jim Beard, has managed to keep at bay the Ultra Humanite.
Batman wouldn't help them, so now the team's on their own. Black Lightning, Geo-Force, Halo, Katana, Looker, Metamorpho. People of power with a new purpose. They are the Outsiders.
The Outcasters continues its coverage of the Outsiders, and Mike W. Barr's team for the 80s has big changes on the way. With a new home, a new title, and coming soon, the Baxter series. You can find the show on Right On Network with your favorite podcatcher, or listen at thehuntresspodcast.com, and follow us on Twitter at @BatOutcasters. Because to live outside the law or on Twitter, you must be honest.
Superman, Blue Beetle, Captain Marvel, Firestorm, The Crimson Avenger, Batman, Halo, Guy Gardner, The Sandman, Shadow Lass, Dollman, The Star-Spangled Kid, The Flash, The Phantom Stranger, Power Girl, Hawkman, Fury, The Challengers of the Unknown, Nightwing, The Whip, Johnny Thunder, The Suicide Squad, Deadman, The Spectre, Warlord, Amazing Man, Our Man, Adam Strange, Dr. Occult, The Doom Patrol, Captain Comet, Creep, Green Lantern, Uncle Sam, The Guard, Batgirl, Dr. Mid-Jonah Hex, Black Khan, The Manhunter, The Guardians of the Floronic, Blue Devil, Dr. Fate, The Legion of Super, The Secret Origins Podcast, covering every issue of DC's Secret Origins comic from the 1980s. Hosted by Ryan Daly and a multitude of guests from the podcast and blogging community. Secret Origins Podcast. Find it on iTunes and at fireandwaterpodcast.com.
Okay, folks, we're back for break, and yes, we've got Jim back with us. Jim, I've given you a hard time throughout this whole process, but man, seriously, this has been an absolute joy. I've had so much fun with you on the show. Thank you so much for being here. Why don't you tell the listeners where they can find more of you out there in the world?
Well, first and foremost, hit Amazon. Go to amazon.com/author/Jim Beard to see all of my books there. I've got so much cool fiction and a lot of cool nonfiction. Much of it actually comic book related, although I don't have a book on the JSA, but I'm seriously thinking about doing one.
I just picked up your Marvel Team Up book, so thanks for that.
Thank you very much. If you like JSA characters, though, I have a book on the history of the Brave and Bold series, and there's some nice Earth 2 stuff in there, thanks to writer Alan Brennert.
Wow.
Also hit me up at flinchbooks.com. That's F-L-I-N-C-H books.com. That is one of my publishing houses. The other one you can find on Facebook at the Jim Beard and Becky Books page. I actually publish published under both of those names. And I'm also still on X. I'm one of the last people there. and you can find me at writer Jim Beard. Please reach out to me. Tell me that you love me. Tell me that you hate me. I'm just so desperate for attention. I'll take anything. And leave me some freaking reviews of my books, would you guys? Please, come on.
And folks, you'll be able to find in the show notes links to Jim on social media and those websites he just mentioned. So be sure to check the show notes for those links as well. Jim, thank you again for being here. I really, really appreciate it.
Thank you. This was too much fun.
This was a blast. It absolutely was. So folks, that is going to do it. Now come back next episode when we present our first spotlight episode. Yeah. So in December, we'll be spotlighting two JSA-related comics from the 1990s that focus on the holiday season. So that's going to be fun, and I'll be joined by two fantastic guests to help me cover those issues. Who will they be? Come on, people. You know how this works. You're just going to have to wait and find out next episode. Thanks for listening, everyone. Until next time, I'm Shag.
And I'm the Parobeck Jim Beard.
And we're asking you to join the fight
for justice.